Hello and welcome to Pitchside with Toby Reynolds. We are back for Series 2. Each episode of the podcast, we take a deep dive into a different sporting topic with a new guest. I'm your host, Toby, and this week I'll be joined by Katia Whitney and Joe Gardner to discuss Project Darwin and the revamp of English women's cricket. Katia is a writer at Wisden.com and a regular contributor to the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine, while Joe is a professional cricketer for the Sunrisers and a co-host of Our Cricket. Through this episode, we look at why the ECB are changing women's domestic cricket in England, whether the counties selected are the best ones, and what the players think of the changes, as well as predictions for the future. I'm now joined by Katia. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. I'm looking forward to the podcast. It'll be obviously quite an interesting topic talking about Project Darwin and the expansion of women's cricket within the country. And I guess the best place to start is it sort of the right decision, do you think, from the ECB, and has it been too long coming?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the right decision to expand the women's domestic format and try and find a way of boosting the number of professional cricketers in the country, and also just the number of teams in the country. We know with the regional structure at the minute, there's only 8 sides, and that kind of has a bit of a shelf life. So with the ECB saying it's going to be 10 teams in 2028 and then expanding to more teams after that, that's definitely good news. I think you could potentially say that it has to be done now, or it's going to be massively late, because we've got the 100 at the minute, and that's almost like a shiny veneer on the top of the women's domestic format in the UK, because that pulls in, I think it pulled in like 300,000 people in total into stadiums over last summer. And you see that the top flight, like women's cricketers in the 100, are paid fairly well, although nowhere near as well as their male colleagues. So once you go underneath the 100, that's where the problems begin to start. And so much has been invested in the 100, it's almost created a gap between the top level of women's professional cricketers in England and the next level. And that's the gap that the ECB are trying to narrow by bringing the regional systems into line with the counties. So it's a good step moving forward. I think there are definite issues that you can identify with the system they're putting in place, especially after the announcement of which counties are going to get first class or tier one sides first. But it's a step in the right direction. Investment and expansion is always a good thing. And if you think like of the counties that didn't get tier one sides and what they were saying last week and how disappointed they were, only a few years ago it would have been unthinkable for counties to be that disappointed about not getting women's professional sides. So moving forwards is always a good thing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the biggest talking points is the fact it's sort of the third revolution in sort of 8 years in a decade. What sort of has gone wrong with the sort of past of evolutions of sort of women's cricket within the country?
I think going wrong is perhaps the wrong terminology to use potentially. I think it's more that the investment and the infrastructure around women's cricket has been so basic for so many years in England and Wales that you're always going to be playing catch up. The boom that we've seen within women's international cricket and franchise cricket over the last couple of years has happened very, very quickly. And because of the chronic levels of underinvestment that existed before that, the level below that hasn't been able to keep up with the demand of how much expansion there's been at a top level. So if you think about the previous revolutions, if that's what we're calling them, that was the Kia Super League was the last one the Kia Super League was the first one when they introduced that. And that was the first time really domestic cricketers or women's cricketers were paid in England and Wales. So if you think that that's only 8 years ago, that kind of represents the scale of the issue that we're talking about, that the first time women's cricketers in domestic cricketers were paid is 8 years ago. And this is now what we're trying to play catch up with. So you can see how quickly it needs to happen. But it does kind of feel like you invest in one thing and or the ECB invest in one thing and tell us this is the solution, this is the solution. And then we change again. And I think the message from the players and the counties is very much get this one right and make sure that this one is the one that works and the one that we can sustain. And given that there is a long-term plan for this new revolution, we've got the expansion in 2028 and beyond that, we've got 1.3 million per side invested each year for the first 5 years and the potential for promotion and relegation. There's a lot of work that needs to happen, but if we can follow that plan and put a proper structure into place, there's no reason why there does need to be another one. But this really needs to be the one that we're stuck with.
How much of an impact do you think the 100 sort of has had on the growth of women's cricket in particular? Because it's sort of given a platform really for for women's cricket to really come to the forefront of sort of fans' minds, where it really wouldn't have been thought about for 99% of sort of generic cricket fans who go down to the Oval and watch a T20 every so often.
Yeah, well, it's been monumental. Like, there's no competition that's had a bigger impact than the 100, or no single event in women's cricket history in this country that's had a bigger impact on the game than the 100. It would be unthinkable, like I've said before, it'd be unthinkable to have 300,000 people coming to watch women's domestic cricket over the course of a summer, less than 8 years ago, like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that would be unthinkable. So it's had a huge, huge impact. And it's not just about the impact the 100 has had on women's cricket, it's the impact women's cricket has had on the 100. We saw a couple of summers ago when the Commonwealth Games was on, and that for the first couple of weeks of the competition, it was only the men's game that were happening. That was a much poorer product because the women's games weren't happening. Women are an essential part of the 100, and if you take them away, you don't have a competition, you don't have a product that is as sellable as it is at the minute. So when you think about that question, it shouldn't just be what impact has the 100 had for women's cricket, it's what impact has women's cricket had, or the professionalisation of it at a franchise and domestic level had on the game as a whole and the revenue potential for the game as a whole. And that's what people are finally waking up to, is that women's cricket is a marketable and profitable product. If you invest in it and give it the right circumstances to succeed, it will inevitably succeed. And that's not to say that the 100 is, or that the impact the 100 can have is finished. We still, as I've said, the highest paid professional women's player in the 100 is paid less than the lowest paid professional men's player in the 100, and that needs to change. So yeah, there's still a way to go, but the 100's impact has been seismic on the women's game in England.
Do you think that the fact that the hundreds, like without the hundred, that women's cricket still would have got to the stage where it is now, sort of a mainstream product, and the fact that fans love it as much as, if not more, in a lot of ways? Or do you think that without the hundred, that maybe women's cricket might still be where it was 5, 10 years ago?
I think that growth was always inevitable. Like, we'd see women's cricket growing even before the 100, but that growth would have been immeasurably slower. Like, the 100 is the reason that women's cricket has expanded, or domestic cricket has expanded at the speed that it has. That growth was always coming, but it's the speed that the 100 has done for it. So if you look purely at a timescale perspective, then absolutely not. It would not have been at this stage. And also just attracting the biggest international names to English domestic cricket. You know, you can go to a stadium for 40 quid in the summer and see people like, you know, Danny van Niekerk, Marizanne Kapp, Jemima Rodrigues, all these people who are big, big global names. And also the double header factor, you're then watching, you know, at points Ben Stokes or Faf du Plessis or whoever else it is in that same game for 40 quid. That's an incredible product, and it's a really powerful thing. So yeah, I think it's just ridiculous, to be honest, the impact that it's had.
Definitely. Going back more towards sort of Project Darwin and the sort of the county teams, do you think that they've chosen the eight best counties? Because obviously there's quite a lot of talk about whether they're going to give it to the 100 sort of franchises and those sort of cities or counties. Or do you think the fact that they've moved a few away and gone up to Durham and Essex and moved away from the sort of central hubs, that it's actually that's much more beneficial?
I think it's what we can tell from the distribution is we can tell a lot about the ECB's thought process in how they've distributed these sides. There hasn't been any official reasoning as to why the counties were awarded the tier one sides or from the ECB, and nor do we expect there will be. But if you look at the current regions, each region has kind of been split in two, if you like. So for the South region, Hampshire was basically in competition with Sussex for a tier one side, and Kent was in competition with the Oval, and Essex with Lords, and Yorkshire with Durham, and that kind of it. So only one main ground has been given a tier one side for each region their current years. And that makes sense purely from a player pool perspective. There aren't enough players to facilitate two fully professional sides in the same region at the minute. So if you look at the county who are most aggrieved they haven't got a side, which is Kent. Kent has an incredible history in women's cricket. It's the most successful county ever in the Women's County Championship that no longer exists. It's produced players like Tammy Beaumont and Charlotte Edwards and Lydia Greenaway. They've all been through Kent's ranks. But against the might of the Oval, there's simply not going to be enough competition in order to pull a side away from, you know, the home of cricket in South London that is such a go-to location and such a pull for cricket fans to get them in the stadiums. I also know that Kent's, or we also know that Kent's plan involved having the women's side hosted at Beckenham most of the time rather than the county ground. For me, I don't massively see a problem with that. Beckenham has great transport links in South London. It's been the home of Kent Women and the regional side for such a long time. It's also got its own indoor school, fantastic infrastructure. It seems like a good plan. But I think the ECB were very keen on having men's teams and women's teams at the same ground, which there are merits for, definitely. Like if you look at Durham and Yorkshire, like you mentioned, Durham's plan involved the tier one side playing most of their games at Chesterley Street, whereas Yorkshire's plan was to take the side, take the what, well, what the Northern Diamonds would develop into, around the county and display them for like women and girls to see around the county. And Durham were preferred over that. What we'll then see in 2028 when Yorkshire get a tier one side and when Glamorgan get a tier one side is that'll be the first time there'll be two professional sides in what is currently the same region. So there's going to have to be an awful lot of work put in for a player pool to be established that can field a fully professional side. We expect a lot of the Northern Diamonds players will go to Durham, leaving Yorkshire with kind of like an exodus of players. So there's going to have to be a lot of work done to pull those players through. But in terms of 100 hubs as well, it kind of just spreads the demographic or the locations of where we can see women's domestic professional cricket across the summer. And also, if you look at some of the sides like Taunton and all that kind of stuff, that they're sides that could be expected to be the next sides to get 100 county if you were in Durham as well. So there has been a focus on kind of 100 hubs, but it's not been completely the focus. Also, if you look at the 100 hubs that didn't get women's sides, you look at Lords and Middlesex, sorry, Middlesex have been in a lot of financial difficulties that are well documented over the last couple of years. The same with Yorkshire. So I wouldn't be surprised, although there's no like official reasoning on this, that that was some of the reasoning behind waiting a couple of years to give them a tier one county.
Do you think that the fact that, I mean, Kent in particular, and maybe Yorkshire as well, but the fact that, as you mentioned, the ECB was so focused on trying to spread the demographic around the country and having sort of one in sort of each of the regions, as you sort of said, that actually maybe Kent possibly could have put in a better bid than the maybe sort of seven of the other counties, and actually because they're just next to Essex and the Oval, that actually they weren't ever going to really be in with a shot because Surrey maybe had such a good. They were the only team who maybe had a better bid.
I think it's difficult to say, but I think Kent's bid was pretty strong. I think it's just that they were competing against the Oval. And the Oval is such a rich, or Surrey, as we should say, Surrey has such rich financial reserves and such a kind of incredible resources. Like they're looking to build a new outground, I think, and all this kind of stuff. And the transport links around the Oval are amazing, that it just kind of makes sense that the Oval are going to get a side, especially if you're not giving a side to Lords. Then to not like Lords and the Oval get a lot of stick, quite rightly in a way, for being two grounds in London, not that far away from each other, that command such a percentage of the cricket that is put on in the country. If you're not going to give Lords a county and then you don't give the Oval a county, suddenly that becomes no cricket in London at all. And purely from a getting fans through the gates perspective, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. You would want a side in London, the most populous city in the UK with the best transport links. So I think a lot of factors went into Kent not getting a side, not necessarily on the strength of their bid.
Yeah, I mean, it might be the fact that I sort of live in London and I'm a bit London focused as well. But I mean, I always think the fact that London is three or four times bigger than sort of Manchester and Birmingham, which are obviously massive cities themselves, I always think kind of makes sense to have at least some sort of a focus in London because you do draw a lot of people. I've always been surprised that the Oval and Lords haven't hosted any test match, like women's test matches in particular. The fact that they have sort of 8 million people, somewhat local, who would be able to come in rather than having to travel out to Canterbury or wherever. Do you think that that's a big issue as well, that maybe that they maybe should have given another one in London or?
I don't know. I think obviously we've said a lot of stuff went into why Lords didn't get given a tier one county. But if you look at it, Lords have only hosted one Sunrisers game in their entire history. A lot of it is hosted at Chelmsford. So that's not really a surprise. On the test matches point, I'm pretty sure the Oval don't, this is probably incorrect because I'm awful with stats and dates. But I'm pretty sure the Oval has hosted a women's test in like the 1930s or something ridiculous like that. But hopefully, as kind of women's cricket continues to grow and women's test cricket pulls in more audiences, like, you know, the Women's Ashes test was at Trent Bridge last summer, hopefully there'll be more kind of women's international cricket hosted in London. I was at the Women's Ashes T20 at the Oval last year and it was pretty much sold out. And it was an incredible atmosphere. So if you can kind of get the ball rolling on these big stadiums hosting women's cricket, which this tier one system is going to do, then that should feed through into all levels of it and getting more cricket hosted in London and beyond, we should say. But yeah.
Southern Vipers have been sort of probably the most dominant side at the moment within the sort of Rachel Hayo-Flynn and the sort of current domestic setup within the women's game. Do you think that the fact that they're moving, well, not even moving, they're sort of staying in Hampshire, that they'll sort of keep a strong core of players and still continue to be quite a dominant side? Or do you think now that actually players might see this as an opportunity to sort of move around and maybe look to go to the Oval or up further north if they fancy it?
I think the Southern Vipers is such an interesting case study. Like they're so interesting given how much they've won and what kind of club or team they've created. I can't see many of their players wanting to leave a base that they've won an incredible amount of trophies at. And also the Charlotte Edwards factor. Like Charlotte Edwards, I presume, will still be coach there. And working with her is such a pull for players because she wins everything. And she's also Charlotte Edwards, and most of them will have grown up knowing her as the England women's captain and the best that England's ever had. So I can't see that. I think what Southern Vipers have done really well is they've kind of balanced this idea of being a regional side and representing, I think, what they represent, Hampshire, Sussex, some minor counties, Dorset, all that kind of area, at the same time as establishing a strong kind of Southampton narrative behind them as well. I went down to their media day just before the start of the season, and their men's and women's teams, so the Hampshire men's sides and the Vipers, are so well integrated almost. They've got, so Keith Barker, he helps out with their bowlers, and they were training in the nets on the outfield while the twos were playing a game. And it feels very much like this is one Hampshire club. And also, as Hampshire, why wouldn't you want to take advantage of the marketing potential the Vipers have if they've won so many trophies? So the Vipers are a really interesting case study, and because they're going to retain pretty much all of their players, and Charlotte Edwards will continue coaching them, I can't see them really being anything other than continuing to be a dominant force, to be honest.
I mean, a lot of, we've talked about a little bit about the test matches already, but the fact that there isn't any sort of multi-day women's cricket at the moment, do you think that there might be an expansion into this with sort of this being quite a good base to sort of push off?
I don't think the UCV are planning any expansion into women's domestic multi-day cricket. I mean, there's no women's test match in England this summer. And I think we can see where the priority is for developing women's cricket, whether that's right or wrong, and whether women should. I think a lot is made on the success of the women's game being judged as the men's game. So a lot of the time, people measure up the women's game by how it compares to the men's game. And that shouldn't just be the barometer that we use for the women's side. A lot of people say women should be playing test match purely on the basis that that's what the men do. And while I'm a big fan of women's test match cricket, and I really think there should be more of it, I think we need to have more questions about the purpose of that and how high quality women's test cricket is facilitated. If we're building from a ground up scenario, like at the minute, only Australia, really, in India and England play test matches. We saw the South Africa test match against Australia this winter that was pretty much a walkover. So if we're talking about test cricket, I think there needs to be a real developed, thought out plan as to how we make that happen, if that's the direction we want to go in for women's cricket, rather than sticking a test match kind of here, there, and everywhere with no preparation or meaning to them.
A lot of the counties will have sort of said quite a lot within their bids and maybe haven't extended the truth, but will have sort of gone out full guns blazing with a lot of the promises. Can we trust the counties to deliver on a lot of their promises? And what happens if they don't?
I hope so. I mean, there's always going to be a trust factor because before the regional system, the county system was women's domestic cricket, and it was chronically underfunded and not treated as it should have been. So I think there's always going to be a little bit of a trust issue between counties and women's cricket. But there's been so much progress since then, and there's been so much turnover, and stuff's moved on so much that I think we can put the counties in good faith. Also, they're all getting 1.3 million for the first 5 years of this system, and that money is ring fenced for investment into the women's sides in terms of player salaries, facilities, expansion, all that kind of stuff. So with that investment, I think it makes it a lot easier to trust the counties. And if they don't deliver on their promises, well, they'll be missing out, because they'll be missing out on financial, marketing, revenue points of view. Because once that 5 years is done, my understanding is that those tier one sides are expected to be self-running and then self-funding. So if you've not used that time in order to set up your women's side where it can make you money, that's your problem.
Do you think that there'll be any impact with the fact that the ECB announced that there would be Yorkshire Anglemorgan joining sort of 2 years after. Obviously, Durham probably quite aggrieved by that, that they thought that they were going to have it sort of all on their own and have that sort of northern region. And the fact that maybe these sort of this announcement that these two and there'll be another two, I think, in 2030 or maybe a bit later than that. Do you think that there's an issue there that maybe the ECB wasn't quite as open as to what their plan was, or do you think it was just the fact that there were so many goods bids that they had to kind of increase it?
I think this whole process has been kind of shrouded in mystery and no one's really known what's going on with it. And I think counties would appreciate a little bit more clarity, particularly those who didn't get the first round of sides. But we're moving away from a regional system. This is no longer meant to be about different regions and getting the northern region. This is about putting the women's system into line with a county system, into line with men's first class sides and doing that. So, you know, if Durham, as you say, are annoyed that they're not going to have that northern region. Well, that northern region is huge. You know, if you're talking Sheffield to, you know, Newcastle, that's a massive, massive swathe of land. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem. Also, if you're talking about Glamorgan, Glamorgan is a country. You know, I spoke to the Glamorgan the person who was behind their bid called Amy Rees at the before the announcement happened, and her ethos was very much like, this is not just a county, it's a country. So I don't think they see it as sharing a region. I think it's about them having a Glamorgan women's team that is separate from Somerset or Western Storm or whatever you want to call it.
And then finally, what are your predictions for how it will fare over the next few years?
I think we've got to be ready for a messy couple of years as everything settles down and gets sorted. We can't expect it to all work straight away without any blips or hiccups or whatever. It's going to be a messy few years as you get to grips with a new system and what that means. And also when the new sides are added, there's going to be more matches, there's going to be more players, and it's going to be a lot to get used to. But hopefully the end result when it comes will be worth it, but it's going to take time. I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be worth it. As I said before, expansion, investment, ambition primarily is what we always want in women's cricket. And if you can say anything about this plan, it's expansive, it gives investment, and it's highly ambitious. So hopefully, all things considered, it should be a really positive step. And in 5 years' time, we'll look back and think, oh, what were we worried about?
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Katja.
It's all right.
Now joined by Joe. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, Toby. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into this chat about, you know, the revamp to women's game, and I guess it came a bit out of the blue, but I guess the best place to start really is how did you find out about the, you know, all the changes that were coming in, and what were your first thoughts?
I think initially it was probably a few months ago where the ECB kind of shared a document with us that the Tier one process would be going to tender, and the first class counties had the opportunity to kind of put their bids forward to take over from the current eight regions that there are at the moment, knowing that kind of our first class counties that we're paired with at the moment are Middlesex, Essex, and Northants. So kind of assumed that it would go to one of those, but equally it wasn't that clear whether or not, like a Kent, for example, if their bid was really strong. And Surrey were going to win like the Stars bid, whether or not they could potentially take over us. It was a bit I guess complicated, and it still kind of is. So that was going on from pretty much the start of the year, the process of all of that, having conversations and trying to work through with us as players what we wanted the bid to look like. So the PCA had been working with ECB and kind of gone out to all the reps and asked what was important for us as players in a bid, so that the independent panel could kind of, I guess, mark off a bit of a checklist kind of thing against what we'd put forward and then what the bids they'd received looked like. And then, yeah, as a result, Essex were the winning bid for kind of our region. But yeah, it was the way that we actually found out. We were playing a warm-up game at Merchant Taylor's School against the Blaze prior to the beginning of the Rachel Hayer-Flint Trophy getting underway. And then a message kind of came on the pitch saying, oh, there's been a leak. The the announcements, because we were meant to find out on the Thursday and this was the Wednesday. It was, oh, there's been a leak, the tier one winners are getting announced this afternoon, and it was all a bit like heads were a bit all over the place. And then yeah, we came off the pitch and they were like, Essex have won the bid. And yeah, just uncertain times really, with the entity changing, but it'll all be for the better, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully so. I think the one big benefit for me anyway is the fact that the ECB are trying to make this change and obviously feel something was wrong or needed to change, or at least they're trying to be proactive about it all. Do you think that, this is the third sort of revolution almost within 8 years in the women's game? Do you think that there was sort of some sort of big issues with all the with the way it was set up over the last few years?
I wouldn't say there were like massive issues. I think they've done really well in kind of this evolution of it in the eight regions that were already there. But I guess for me personally, like when somebody asks me who it is that I play for and what it is that I do, and I say, oh, I'm a professional cricketer for the Sunrisers, they say, well, who's that? What's that? And it can be a little bit difficult to explain because there's not really any, I guess, known alignment of what Sunrisers is. I guess for some of the other regions, like your Western Stormwind, Southern Vipers, Thunder, for example, that have been around since the Super League, there is a little bit more history behind them, I guess. But for us Sunrisers, you know, starting out from zero at the beginning of this kind of restructure that we're currently in before it moves across the counties. I guess, yeah, like the identity side of it is probably one that I feel like the ECB want to evolve, especially on the back of how successful the hundred's been in the kind of the pairing of the men's and women's teams being kind of one team, one brand, being easily recognisable to fans, spectators, obviously makes it a lot easier having one venue, stuff like that. So I can see why they've gone down this route to kind of realign with the counties, I guess, because they're already quite well established.
You're as you mentioned, you're at the Sunrisers at the moment. Has there been much sort of communication to you guys about how the sort of this re-signing or sort of transfer system might look like? Have you spoken to Essex already, for example, or is it all being pushed back until after the season now that's going on at the moment finishes?
Yeah, we've had a few conversations with Essex and they've tried to be as, I guess, transparent as possible in kind of what it is that they're going through. They're working quite closely with the ECB as well as I think Somerset and Durham as well, obviously in a similar position to Essex. So yeah, they're trying to keep lines of communication as clear as possible. We're going down as a group on Thursday to kind of visit Colchester as one of the potential training sites. So I guess just gauge a bit more info around what that looks like and delve a little bit more into what the Essex bid actually consisted of, to make us, I guess, more informed in that regard. As far as the contract side of things goes, I think that's still kind of being sorted out. I know the PCA have been in like good conversations with the ECB and like I guess the legalities and the like the binding of the contracts and stuff is it, yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky one, but I think there is like an agreement if your contract is due to expire, say at the end of 2025, the change of entity, so Essex would have to fulfill anyone's contract that expires in 2025, but there are quite a lot of our girls that have contracts that expire at the end of this year. So essentially, it's a matter of how quickly can Essex try and onboard as many of the girls currently within the Sunrisers that they want to tie down into contracts as quickly as possible, but trying to play a cricket season as well and focus on the job at hand for us as professional cricketers is kind of what's at the forefront of our minds, definitely at the moment. And it's been good in that sense that we haven't been dragged into too many like off-field discussions about it. We have been very much focused on churning out performances, whether that be in the Rachel Hayo Flint Trophy or the Charlotte Edwards Cup, which obviously we started yesterday. So yeah, it's all kind of going on, bubbling away behind the scenes, but hopefully in the next month or so, we'll have some more clarity on the contract side of things and yeah, those kind of logistics and what the future might look like come September, October time.
You mentioned sort of some of the discussions, the offer discussions you guys haven't had a huge number of. What has been the sort of overall feeling of sort of your Sunrisers, for example, with your teammates? Is it mainly positive and are people mainly excited for it?
Yeah, I would say so. Obviously, there is quite a lot of uncertainty with our region's so big. So we've got people in Essex, we've got people in North London, we've got people in South London, we've got people in North Ants. So the region is so vast and kind of players are here, there and everywhere. There is the relocation element to the kind of decision that's been made. So I guess there's a little bit of uncertainty with that and what the next 5 months, where people might be in 5 months' time, for 6 months' time, for example. And yeah, I think it's just, we're just trying to gather as much information and gauge as much as we can from Essex to for everyone to be in a position where they can make the best decision that's right for them. I think, but on the whole, I think people are positive and yeah, like excited about what's to come, because I'm sure as we've seen over even the past few years, how much the game's grown in kind of popularity and like the streams have obviously been doing really well. So people are genuinely more interested. This has grown exponentially. Obviously the pool of players that are available for England to select is fantastic. And that's only as a result of the kind of ambition and drive that the ECB have for the domestic game in this country.
Do you think that it'll be a slightly weird feeling, perhaps, knowing that maybe some of you guys might not necessarily be playing together next year, particularly if other counties come in and maybe not try and poach people, but people might sort of move around and go to different counties? Is that going to be a slightly odd feeling that, you know, just the core of Sunrisers might not necessarily be together at Essex next year, or you might be sort of all over the country?
Yeah, I guess it's a very real possibility and something that I think we're all aware of. And yeah, because we haven't necessarily had those contract discussions or whatever with Essex as yet, we don't know where we all stand in that sense. So I guess that's the unknown bit that people are, I guess, can't get too positive or too excited about, because we're just not sure exactly what that might look like. I think it would be disappointing if we were to lose a chunk. Obviously, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing at this stage. Like, no one really knows if they're necessarily fully wanted by Essex or things like that. Ideally, the core of us would stay together and the playing group and the staff wouldn't look too dissimilar. But this is Essex's baby to grow, I guess. They've got to have their take on it in working in collaboration with what already exists. But yeah, I guess that's professional sport at the end of the day. You know that you're going to have people moving around and what might be right for one player isn't right for another, whether that's playing opportunity, relocation, salary, all things like that have got to be taken into consideration. Obviously, we've got a few young guns in the team as well that are coming through and players that are slightly older. So people are at different stages in their careers and who knows, opportunity might be better at a different region in the country. But yeah, I think on the whole, it is exciting.
With those young girls you mentioned there who are either coming through or even some perhaps in the academy still, have you spoken to them much? And do you know how sort of they're all feeling, particularly as they maybe haven't had the opportunity to prove themselves in first team cricket as much and therefore maybe aren't front and centre in the minds of some of the counties?
I haven't spoken massively to like too many of the girls. Like, we don't really cross paths with the academy that much. Like, once the season gets started with where their kind of training sessions are and them still being at school and a few of them at uni and things like that. So that's quite an interesting one. I feel like we probably should do more and see where they're at with it all. But I would like to think that they would be quite energised by it, knowing that in theory it should be more accessible for them to become a professional, knowing that the number of contracts and stuff's going to increase as well. But I guess they have a lot on their plate as well, obviously, when they've not quite broken through into the first team, as you say, or they're still studying and they've got decisions to make on in that regard. How that might impact their cricket in future is, I guess, a little bit unknown, isn't it? So yeah, for the younger girls, I guess it is a bit more unsettling potentially.
Yeah, definitely. One of the sort of the main reasons I think that this is all coming about now is the fact that the women's game has grown so much over the last couple of years. Particularly the 100, I think, has had a big effect on that, putting you guys on the same platform as the men, which hasn't really happened throughout sort of cricketing history otherwise. Do you think that the 100 has sort of almost proven that the women's game just needs that sort of space to grow in the platform to sort of really push itself off, and that this is perhaps what that platform will be?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, yeah, not just the 100. I think you saw the way that the Ashes was marketed last year with the men's and women's Ashes kind of aligned in their marketing roles. We saw unprecedented numbers attending the women's internationals for the Ashes. And I guess part of that will be like that audience would have been generated from the first few years of the 100 in getting more like women and families go into these games, and I guess just energizing them in that sense. But yeah, you're absolutely right in that the 100, obviously, initially the 100 wasn't ever meant to be like two teams, one venue kind of vibe. It was only because of COVID that came about as a result. Like the women's games were going to be played at a few of the other 18 first class counties. So I know like Chelmsford and Northants, for example, were due to host a few of the women's games. So actually, the fact that it did go to kind of two teams, one venue, and that whole platform for the women has been, yeah, I don't think like haven't looked back in that sense. I know definitely from a player's perspective, I've been so fortunate and grateful to be involved in those first few years of the 100, and it is just like the spectacle and hype and the way that you're treated, the access to facilities and coaches and all of that stuff is like second to none. It's you it's like no stone's been unturned, and it's the same, like you are just treated in the same regard as the men on the whole. So yeah, I think that's the ambition, to get the women's game in this new structure kind of on that par with the men. And hopefully the 100 will have been a bit of a springboard for this to be successful in the next few years.
From your point of view as a player, what do you think the sort of the main things that need to be nailed from the outset is by the counties in particular?
I think getting a training base is something that's really important, definitely for us at Sunrisers, is having a training base that's established that we can kind of resonate with and call home in that regard. I think that's quite an important thing. I know for players around the country as well, like knowing that you've got a consistent training venue that's got your gym, your physio access, you're getting catered for in some regard. Like yeah, your recovery bits, indoor and outdoor training, stuff like that. I think that's really important. As well as I guess just driving the professional standard forward. So some regions might be short on a few coaches on a match day, for example, and they might be having to draw people up from the pathway. So like the academy and EPP coaches who might be around on a first 11 match day. We can get to a point where that doesn't need to be the case, and we've got more full-time support staff in and around the environment. That would obviously be fantastic. And yeah, I guess just trying to really nail the branding and commercial side of it, which as a team of the 100 should in theory be easier, knowing that the first class counties can market us alongside the men.
And then finally, I guess the predictions for the future. Do you think that the eight best counties have been chosen, and do you think it will work and will sort of progress women's cricket?
I think it will definitely progress women's cricket. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure like a lot of other people in the north, they were surprised that Yorkshire didn't get get given a county with kind of their reputation in the women's game, how many kind of women and girls have got playing cricket up there and stuff like that. I know that's going to be a bit of a tricky one for the Northern Diamonds to navigate at this kind of time. But yeah, I think the way that the game has gone in the last few years, like even the last 2 or 3 years, this change can only be a good thing. And obviously, the backing that the ECB are putting behind it and giving the platform to these first class counties to, yeah, I guess just springboard the game and try and grow it as best as they can, try and make it more professional and more attractive to spectators, to players, all things like that. I think it will only be good for the game. But it might not necessarily happen overnight, which I think is also something that fans probably need to bear in mind a little bit as well. I know when the game did start turning more professional, you did kind of feel as a player like, oh, there's this expectation on me that now I'm training full time, that the performances and the outcome are just going to change overnight, when actually it doesn't quite happen like that. There is a little bit of like a little bit of a lagging period. But on the whole, I think it's absolutely the right thing.
Amazing. Well, Joe, thank you so much. It's been great speaking to you.
Thanks, Toby.
Thank you all so much for listening. Make sure you head over and follow us on social media. It's pitchside_podcast on Instagram and TobyReynolds10_ on Twitter and TikTok. You'll also be able to find my guests' social medias in the description down below. Make sure you like the podcast and give it a rating. It really does help. And join us next time on Pitchside with Toby Reynolds for another deep dive into a different sporting topic.